And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Cliff Pickover with us. What an author he is. Published more than 50 books on topics ranging from science and mathematics to religion, art, and history. He received his PhD from Yale University's Department of Molecular Biophysics and Biochemistry. He's been granted more than 250 patents, and his research has received a heck of a lot of attention from media outlets, from CNN, Wired, to the New York Times, and us as well. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Cliff, looking forward to this. Hi.
Great to hear from you. Thanks.
Everything well? What have you been doing the last few years?
Oh, everything is fine. You know me, I'm working on my books, my tweets, my day job. And Death in the Afterlife, that's my latest book. Very artistic. All the entries are illustrated, and I'm sure we're going to have a lot of fun and curiosity talking about it.
Oh my gosh, I just love that. But how did a molecular scientist, get involved in even writing books on this genre, death and the afterlife?
Well, I think I've always been curious, from a young age on topics on right on the borderlines of science, touching on science fiction, and even though I have my PhD in a very hardcore science, at night. Like you, right? We wonder about the mysteries of the world, and what better way than to talk about some of the things in my books, which go from time travel to alien life, and even death in the afterlife.
Have you been following that bizarre story of so-called megastructures at a star some 1,400 plus light years away? Scientists, specifically one from Penn State University, made the remark off the cuff that this was a very unusual structure around a star found by Kepler, and that he basically said, in addition to all the real science possibilities, this could also be an alien structure. Well, he meant it as his last possible explanation, if they could never find a reason for it. And we tried getting him on the program, and he just went nuts, saying that the media has blown everything out of proportion. But we've got an interview coming up with him next week.
That really captures the imagination. Scientists look toward the heavens and look at the light emitted from faraway stars, and based on what's happening to that light, I believe, for this case, they're thinking there must be some huge object that's blocking the star to a certain extent. And that's really fascinating.
And they say it's not a planet, so who knows what it is, but it's exciting. I mean, I do believe in extraterrestrial life. It's out there. But I also believe in life after death. I mean, I've gotten to that point, Cliff, where I went through a spell, very short spell, that I did not believe in life after death. And it was a cold, stark, frightening feeling. And I thank God I got out of that, let me tell you.
Yes, well, it certainly fascinated humanity, probably since the dawn of civilization, and affected our art, our religions, our philosophy, our physics to some extent. So it's really, really fascinating.
You started your book, The Death and the Afterlife, with the ancient Nafufian culture. What the heck is the Nafufian culture anyway?
Yeah, that's something I find most people have never heard of. Let's go back about 11,000 BC, and imagine yourself in the Eastern Mediterranean, in the modern area of Israel. And what scientists have found recently is that these Stone Age graves have had colorful, very aromatic flowers. And it suggests to us, looking back, from today's vantage point, mm-hmm. that these people really started it all and probably had a certain type of respect and ritual. And we can speculate on possible beliefs in an afterlife, the way they were treating their dead.
There's no doubt that many of the ancients, and as you say, 11,000 years before Christ, that they treated their dead with respect. It may go back even further.
You are so right. We've actually looked at Neanderthal graves in Iraq, back maybe 70,000 years. And, of course, as you go so far back, it becomes less certain. They clearly arranged their dead beneath ground, which showed some sort of care and interest in death. And there's also speculation that they too may have used flowers to decorate the graves, which suggests a kind of deeper thinking about the whole thing.
I find cemeteries, Cliff, to be somewhat sad because, you know, it's kind of fascinating to read the tombstones and the etchings that are on them, the years that people were born and died, who they were, whether they were little children or grown adults or old people. But I find them to be very sad because there was a life form that lived on this planet, had an existence, and now it's gone and possibly off into the afterlife. But you've done some work into cemeteries, too, and you say that cemeteries tell us something about who we are.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I date the entry on cemeteries to 1831, which sounds kind of new. Obviously, we've been burying dead for ancient days in church graveyards and thus. But this 1831 date refers to this large Mount Auburn Cemetery in Massachusetts, which really started the movement to build cemeteries in the U.S. with these big park-like structures. But you're right. When you go through cemeteries today, you feel a little bit of something, as if there's a presence. And of course, it can be sad. In one part of the book, I talk about epitaphs, just like you were saying, what's on some of them.
Yeah.
And they can go from funny to serious.
That's true. There was one in Tombstone about Less and More. His name was Less More, and there's just a great writing about him. Here lies Less, he is no more, or something like that. But you're right. Some people get comical about that.
Yeah, Shakespeare, he has one, blessed be the man that spares these stones, and cursed be he that moves my bones.
Aren't some of these tombstones now, don't they have videos in them?
They do, and you can wonder, what's it going to be like in 100 years, so many of us have a digital presence online. Will they have our tweets? Will they have digital representations of us that can almost talk to us with an artificial intelligence? It may sound kind of creepy, but who knows where we're headed, because we're getting so advanced in our understanding of the mind and the brain, and we're all leaving digital trails behind.
And the name of your book, of course, is Death and the Afterlife, which leads me to believe that you have some belief system in the afterlife. Is that right?
Yes. Well, this is another topic I think about all the time. I actually go into some of the physics ideas of an afterlife. We've all heard about afterlives, in religion, in heaven. It goes back into all the ancient civilizations up to now have had belief in an afterlife. But even physicists have talked about, could we be immortal through quantum processes and things like that. And even that's a kind of afterlife. Living in simulations like the Matrix is kind of afterlife. So you're probably getting at, the religion afterlife, which is interesting and something we all speculate. But it's hard to believe that even physicists talk about afterlives through quantum theory.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about quantum resurrection. What is that?
In fact, that's one of the last entries in the book. Quantum theory or quantum mechanics is the science of the tiny, tiny subatomic particles and atoms. And based on that, scientists have speculated in something called quantum resurrection. And the idea is this. Our universe expands forever and ever, which looks like it is currently the way things are going in our universe. And even when stars eventually die out, you're still going to have residual energy fields and random fluctuations in space. And according to quantum theory, tiny particles are going to pop into and out of existence just based on thermal fluctuations. Anyway, to get to the crux of the matter, if little particles can pop in and out, if you have a universe that lives for an infinite amount of time, big objects will eventually, just by the laws of chance, pop in and out. And even you and me, it's hypothesized, will pop into existence just because particles will, by chance, come together. And there's whole fields of science now talking about quantum resurrection.
With this belief in the afterlife, what do you think it is?
Well, I think we're all, you know, we have such little time on this earth. We know so little about our ancestors. You know, maybe our children will know about us and our grandchildren, and then eventually we'll be like a dying ember in a fire. Who's going to remember us in the generations that come? So we all yearn for that. Now, of course, we all leave traces behind. That's a kind of afterlife. There's other types of, you know, we can get into something called quantum immortality, which is another type of afterlife. But it makes me wonder, you know, through time, heaven and hell and all these concepts have been very common throughout, you know, throughout history. And because of that, and because of our interest in it, you know, we will always wonder, I think, about the truths. A lot of this is beyond logic, I think. You know, that's why there's faith. But as science learns more, the mystery, I think, deepens.
Some people are so obsessed with death, Cliff, and living that they have put themselves in cryogenic chambers where they have literally liquid nitrogen themselves, right, into a freezing state.
Yes, the fact that I talk about in the book. Yeah, it happens when you're legally dead. You can sign up for cryonic preservation. And you're right, they freeze the body or the head with liquid nitrogen down to about, you know, minus 320 degrees Fahrenheit. And to try to protect the cells in your body, which would normally get damaged when ice crystals form, they pump in cryoprotectants. You know, I keep saying they, but they're institutions that do this.
Right.
And, you know, maybe this also sounds far-fetched, but just remember, even today, people freeze embryos, and they're routinely resurrected to produce healthy children. And many scientists have frozen animals like pigs, no pulse. They're frozen with no, taking the blood removed, no brain electrical activity, and they are resurrected seemingly healthy. And it makes you wonder if cryonic preservation will work. And let's say we're frozen and we're science is able to resurrect us in 50 or 100 years because science will have learned how to do it. During that time of zero brain activity, did we enter an afterlife? Are we now suddenly coming back? You know, it makes you wonder where death and life end and begin, right? It becomes a little bit murky.
Or are we in some kind of suspended animation form? Who knows by that time?
That's right. And people talk about afterlife in a simulation. Many people think that the brain will be so well understood that we'll be able to simulate beings, or we'll be able to simulate ourselves and software. You know, this idea of simulation, almost like the Matrix, is something that even seasoned scientists talk about.
Just my luck to go into a cryogenic chamber, Cliff, and have them drop me. That would shatter your body, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. or if the freezing chamber, you know, went dead for, you know, a few days, right? That wouldn't be too good either.
Not at all. Do you think we can live almost until the end of time?
Well, I do think, you know, that we can think about from many levels, right? Biologically speaking, I think we'll become, you know, whether we like it or not, we'll have achieved immortality in this century in the sense that the mysteries of aging, you know, why our bodies age, you know, why we get cancer, that will be figured out just like so many other biological things. And at that point, in principle, you shouldn't die very fast because we'll understand it totally. Now, going beyond that, right, there's all sorts of another quantum thing I talk about is quantum immortality. That's another branch of thinking about, you know, living forever. There's scientists in physics who, now, this is a big phrase, but it's called the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. And it says whenever the universe is confronted with a choice of paths at the quantum level, like an atom might radioactively decay,
yeah,
or not, the universe follows both paths. And if that's true, there's a set of universes where we virtually live forever. And there's all sorts of thought experiments we could get into that. But it has to do with, well, one universe you die because something goes wrong. Even if, like, you're putting an electric chair, right? The switch is flicked. In one universe, you die. In another universe, something fails with the electrical system. You live. Both universes are equally real according to some ideas of quantum mechanics. You just keep living in the universe that keeps permitting you to live. Isn't that weird?
It sure is. You saw the movie The Matrix, right?
Sure, we all love that.
Do you ever wonder whether we are actually living in the Matrix?
That's another fascinating topic. And I love all those movies where, you get you to question
Oh
reality.
my gosh, thought-provoking, aren't
There's
they?
many Dark City, The Matrix, and we're already getting closer and closer to artificial intelligence. We can simulate, just with mathematics and simple rules, lifelike things in the computer. Who knows what will happen in 100 years? And some have speculated if civilizations can simulate people or reality, and each universe, there may be many universes, let's say there's 100 simulations, and those simulations can simulate other simulations beneath them, then perhaps you and me are already simulated, because if that becomes common, who's to say?
Well, that's a good point. It's a good point.
So,
See, I think that's how telepathy occurs and things like that. We get into this matrix and it hooks everybody together.
and can you imagine trying to detect it? Maybe even through physics, as you look smaller and smaller size scales, you read something, say, "Whoops, that doesn't sound right. It looks like we're digital in a computer." And you if you want to stretch that to the afterlife, right? In theory, maybe an afterlife would be we're in this simulation and we get to bump up a level into a higher simulation. And there have been very serious physicists, computer scientists that since even the 60s. Let's talk about how our universe in some ways could be thought of as a digital simulation.
Cliff, I want you to speculate for a moment on when someone dies, kind of take us through the possibilities of what happens to them.
Well, there's of course the medical aspect where and this was very it's very fascinating because the line right between life and death is pretty flimsy. So if you want to talk about brain death first, right? Eventually, the brain will stop or slow down its function as oxygen is reduced and the heart, stops. But EEGs are infallible, are not infallible, right? You can be in these states that seem very low level and still be alive on some level, and that's one of the challenges of brain death is when are you really dead? And then, of course, I know you're interested in. Near-death experiences. What do people tell us when they're at near death, or right at the edge of death? And that's also a fascinating subject that people, even back to the time of Plato, have been wondering about the near-death experience, and what it means. Whatever it does mean, right? It seems to have profound, lasting psychological effects on people. So if people have experienced it, whether we think it's real or it's something telling about us about the nature of the human brain, whatever it is, it's fascinating, important to study because it changes people's and their perception of reality and their lives.
Cliff, Steve Jobs' last words to looking beyond his family when they were at his deathbed was, "Wow, wow, wow." What do you think he was seeing?
Yeah, and I think Timothy Leary, he said his last words were, "Why not?"
Yeah, and
Yeah,
Frank
so.
Sinatra's last words, "I'm losing."
So, yes, collecting the last words of the dying is fascinating. What did Steve Jobs think? What did he see?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, to
Oh,
say that three times.
oh
Wow,
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 oh
wow.
wow, oh
Yeah.
wow.
What was he looking at? What was the vision that he saw? Do you think he saw his loved ones come for him? What do you think?
Did he see his life, sort of a life review flash before him? Did he see a different reality? Did he just have a flood of, emotions based on what was happening? Very hard to know.
All right, stick with us. We're going to take this quick break, then we're going to be back in a moment with Cliff Pickover talking about his work, Death in the Afterlife, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Cliff Pickover with us. Cliff, heaven and hell, do they exist?
Well, certainly the. Through time, we've thought they've existed, and they could, exist in many different styles or ways of looking at it. If we go back in time, right, the ancient Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans, and the Native Americans, heaven was real for them. It was a place where God resided for many, where we went after after death. But, you know, there's some interesting speculations in modern times. I found this interesting. The Christian evangelist named Ann Lott, she actually gave dimensions to heaven. She said it's a cube, 1,500 miles on a side. And that's kind of interesting to speculate. Well, how many people could you really fit in something like that? But, you know, speaking about heaven, I'm very fascinated by the commonalities in the ideas of heaven and hell through time. You know, the ancient Egyptians for heaven had a field of reeds. The early Hebrews, they didn't emphasize life after death. But after this Babylonian exile of the Jews, where they didn't seem to get justice in this world, and the afterlife made more and more sense. So heaven exists everywhere through time. Now, hell also started out in an interesting way. It was not always this idea of eternal punishment for the bad. It's more like an underworld where souls would wander around. And you know, we could get into that about what the Israelites and the Greeks thought, but that concept has been there, it seems to be, in you know, all civilizations through all time.
Was it created in order to try to control mankind? If you could discipline them, let them know that there's this evil place, that they will be more apt to listen to you and be, you know, march to your tune?
Well, I think that's a good point. If we look at it sort of anthropologically, heaven and hell probably had good benefit for societies because, as you say, it sort of keeps cultures together, binds them together. You know, it makes, as you say, march to a tune. The various prophets have returned with laws to give humanity. Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. The Greek, you know, one of the most interesting hells, you might say, I think, is the Greek Hades, where, you know, both good and evil people resided. They had a beautiful place in Hades called the Elysian Fields. That's what I like to dream about when I go to sleep, these endless fields and meadows. That was like a heaven for them. But it resided in one, at least in some of the literature, in Hades.
Huh.
And then they had the worst part of Hades was called Tartarus. And that was a pit of, that was kind of like a pit of torment for the most wicked.
Fire and brimstone?
Yes, that sort of thing. And that, and of course, the New Testament, that that gets more into the fire and brimstone even more.
What's interesting, though, is so many cultures pick up on that. I don't know if the Greeks were the first to create that heaven and hell possibility, but other cultures had the same thing, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, we can go back to the ancient Babylonians, and they had notions of heaven. The ancient Egyptians, of course, they were interested in preserving their bodies through mummification so that it would help in an afterlife, but they had a kind of heaven. It seemed like all cultures, or almost all cultures, have that idea of future existence. Of course, with Christianity and Jews and Islam, it's more of, you know, we die and then we'll go to this afterlife. In some of the Eastern religions, right, there's a more of a notion of reincarnation, where it's not so linear, it's more cyclical. Mm-hmm. You come back.
What do you think of reincarnation?
Well, that's also interesting because, you know, again, what it seems to be a common theory or a common idea in Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism, this cyclical process. But even for these repeating cycles, really, when you think about it, their goal is to kind of escape this cycle and, you know, finally achieve something called, I think it's called moksha with Hinduism, where the Buddhists have nirvana. But even ancient Pythagoreans, about the 5th century B.C., Pythagoras, who was one of the great mathematicians, they even believed in reincarnation, became vegetarians because they thought we could be reincarnated by animals.
It's fascinating what all these cultures used to believe and still do. You talked about the Israelites and what their belief system is. Does that echo the Greeks, for example?
Yes, I mean, they had that similarity with the notion of an afterlife. The traditional Israelites in Judaism didn't have a reincarnation, of course, and you know, certain of these Greek sects, even the Pythagoreans, did have reincarnation. But the Israelites had this place called Sheol, which seem to be underground. There's a fascinating tale in the Bible, the Torah, called the Witch of Endor, where King Saul, who said necromancy is illegal, no one should do it. That's sort of talking to the dead. He decides before a battle, this ancient Israelite king, to consult the Witch of Endor to summon up the spirit of the prophet Samuel, and he says, "Why have you disturbed me and brought me up?" Which suggests that these ancient Israelites had the notion of, you know, beneath the ground there is something. It wasn't all that beautiful and heavenly like today's vision, I think, of heaven. But anyway, the Witch of Endor summons up this prophet for him, and unfortunately the message is, you know, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. And so that doesn't go so well for King Saul.
Have you heard of the guff in ancient Hebrew?
Well, I talk about the golem, which is ancient, you know, where they create an ancient sort of a machine-like creature. What are you speaking of?
Well, I think the guff is like a hall for souls. It's like a depository. And,
interesting.
And that's where the souls are. It's very ancient Jewish mythology about it. They talk about how the angel Gabriel was the first to reach in and take the first soul out. Off they went. But interesting. Study up on that, if you would, because there's been some talk. What happens if the Hall of Souls runs empty, that there are no more left?
Yes, that is interesting. I mean, and there are many other things in the ancient Israel writings, right? We talk about the Jacob's ladder that stretches to heaven. That's a fascinating concept, where it looks like souls or angels are going back and forth to heaven. The golem, if you're interested in ancient Judaism, also, this is something I discuss in the book, where it starts about the year 1580, where a Prague rabbi allegedly creates this creature like out of clay to defend the Jews in the ghettos. And now all throughout history, there's this idea of the golem. It's a creature that you can create and activate, but actually turning it off is often the problem. You can create it and you can do these dumb repetitive tasks. But anyway, the word golem actually appears once in the Bible. And if your listeners are interested, you know, G-O-L-E-M. It's a being that the ancient Jews, talk about, and in the Middle Ages, Jews talk about creating.
I think Hitler was obsessed with the golem too, wasn't he?
I think so.
I think a lot of
societies were interested, obsessed, and you know, maybe we can speculate. It's the idea of this powerful thing that could protect you. You know, what could defend you against this magical, unformed creature that could, you know, keep on going and protect you. But as with all experiments in life, like I also talk about the Frankenstein story, right? Sometimes what happens if you actually get what you want and it goes too far, how do you stop the whole process?
Yeah, exactly. Tell me about your thoughts on electro voice phenomena.
Yeah, that's something that's fascinating. I know you're probably very interested in that topic through your shows and writings. This is the idea that started, at least from my perspective, around the 1950s, where people would listen to reel-to-reel tapes. And I myself had, you know, in the good old days, reel-to-reel tape recorders, where you record basically nothing, increase the volume, and in the noise, the idea of electronic voice phenomena is you'd hear messages, words, short phrases. And, you know, when Thomas Edison was asked about this sort of thing, he said that nobody knows whether our personalities pass on to another existence or sphere, but it may be possible to construct an apparatus. So he was probably having something of this in mind. He thought it would be better than the mediums of the day. Anyway, with electronic voice phenomena, people have listened to this. It's fascinating. Of course, skeptics would call this, there's a fancy word, pareidolia, you know, where we humans are pattern-seeking creatures. We see patterns in leaves and in the sand, And, you know, you might say, well, of course, if you listen to a noisy recording, you may start to hear things. But I've listened to a number of them and even played around myself. And, you know, I like the idea. It's very, it's interesting. In fact, I just tweeted something. My Twitter is called, you know, Pickover, my last name, where I actually recently tweeted some samples of sounds created through the electronic voice phenomena tapes, and they're very curious to listen to.
Sometimes they're very difficult to hear, but when a good one comes through, it is strange, isn't it?
Yeah, well, one of the ones that I talk about is the Spiracom device around 1980, and I don't know if you know if that's considered today to be a little bit fraudulent or it's real, but when you listen to it, you say, ooh, that's interesting. And, you know, in the book, I take it even, you know, we think of electronic voice phenomena mostly with these tape recorders and other devices. But even in literature and in divination, people have listened to sounds. And one of my favorite entries in the book is called The Grass Harp. The Grass Harp is a novel by Truman Capote in the early 50s. And one of the characters uses the sound of wind through the grass to hear voices of the departed. And the writing is so poetic, you know, I think your listeners would enjoy it, where this tall grass changes color with the seasons and the wind blows through it, and you hear the messages of the town echoed. It's fascinating. And, of course, cultures through the centuries have used randomness in nature to try to communicate with spirits, whether it's, you know, listening to the trees and the birds. Even seashells have been used in China and other cultures where you open up your mind, you try to be more receptive and see what messages come. Now, whether the messages are purely from your own being, your own psyche, or whether they're coupled to something else, I mean, that's fascinating grounds for speculation.
Well, it really is. And why is it that with EVPs, the voices of children tend to freak out a lot of people, including me?
Well, I think anything dealing with children is fascinating because, you know, the children are, you know, more innocent. I mean, when you get into the studies of reincarnation, you probably know about Dr. Ian Stevenson and many others where, you know, they actually interview thousands of young children and try to see what they're thinking about other lives. So I don't know, there's something about children with innocence and yet not being formed that gives us a little, shiver, I think.
You had mentioned in your work the incredible terracotta army that was buried. These are statues now, not people. Back in the 210 to BC era. Tell me, what's the significance of this?
Yeah, I found that fascinating. Well, from a historical area or historical reasons, right, if we go back then, there was an Emperor Qin. He was the first emperor of China that unified the warring states. And he had thousands and thousands of people create this terracotta army made of baked clay, these very lifelike soldiers, farmers, slaves, jugglers, magicians, all created. And now, only in the 1970s, we've discovered them, all buried underground near his burial places. And can you imagine finding, just by accident, 8,000 soldiers in this clay-like form, along with horses, chariots.
Bizarre.
Working weapons. Well, what fascinates me is, today we say, well, how would they think that would protect him in the afterlife? Right, because after all, they're just clay figures. But maybe the question is not so obvious, right? But you go through all the cultures. Ancient Egypt, you know, had things in their burials that were meant to help them in the afterlife. Another thing I talk about is Viking ship burials, where certain Vikings were buried in a complete ship with horses and oxen and dogs and human beings, probably because it was thought that this would assist them in the afterlife. So today it sounds a little unusual, but I think through history, people had that notion of wanting protection, whether it's through these statues, like in the Terracotta Army, or in certain spells. There's the Egyptian Book of the Dead, there's the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where all were meant to assist you gain entrance and be relatively safe in the afterlife.
Do you look forward to the other side? Are you curious?
Well, yeah. I think we all, well, I don't know about all, we all have a little bit of fear. You know, we say, oh, it's sad. This all, you know, has to end. We all think about what could lie beyond. I mean, I have a technique when I go to sleep, and actually it's relaxing. I picture myself, I mean, this may sound weird to you in the audience, wandering through these Elysian fields, these fields in the afterlife, where I set up these images of an afterlife that help me go to sleep. So it's not like a terrible thing. It's very peaceful, you know, of happiness. And, you know, all these questions you're asking me about, you know, what I believe, what do I think about God and the afterlife, I think one of the most interesting things to keep in mind is that we are limited by our 3-pound brain in our heads, right? If you look at a monkey brain, look at a human brain, they're not all that much different. But whatever difference there is, think of everything we can contemplate that a monkey can't. We can think of black holes and poetry and symbolic logic. Similarly, there's probably many, many thoughts that we can barely think because we're limited by our brain. There's visions we can only glimpse, and it's at this filmy, veiled interface between a human reality and what may lie beyond that many of us, even me, you know, scientific guy, will find something very spiritual, maybe close to the numinous. Mm-hmm. That's a nice word, numinous, and that some may liken that to God.
Well, Cliff, what does the future hold for us in terms of the universe? How much time we got?
Yeah, in fact, I end the book, yeah, how much time do
we have? On a bang, so to speak.
On the death of the universe. And, you know, it's beyond 100 trillion years where...
That's a long time.
It closes in various eras where the stars burn out and black holes eventually burn out, and there's, you know, a vast sea of electrons. But who knows, maybe humans will be able to burrow into other universes and higher in other realities, because parallel universes is a theory that many people take seriously today. So it's not all sad. We talked about quantum resurrection, quantum immortality, and simulations. It's all possible ways of maybe even escaping this universe if we find the you know, the means to do it.
There could be many universes.
Yes, parallel universe is something that I think fascinates everyone, lay people, scientists, physicists. And I think if you did a survey of scientists, many, if not most, believe in some type of parallel universe that exists side by side with ours in some ghostly fashion, or even they exist in our own normal universe. Let's say our universe is infinite in spatial extent. We don't know that yes or no yet, but it may be infinite. If it's infinite, that means far, far away in space, just by the laws of chance and the way matter combines, you and me are having the same conversation, or nearly same conversation, just from the laws of mathematics, even though this part of the universe we can't access right now because it's so far away in space. And there's many other theories of parallel universes. One is that many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, with the Big Bang that started billions of years ago, it's thought that there's a budding process with many, many universes. String theory leads to the idea of parallel universes. There's even parallel universes. Now, this is very speculative, but people who take DMT or dimethyltryptamine,
oh, yeah,
right?
They see
universes there.
They see something else, to be sure. Cliff, we're going to come back and take phone calls with you as we talk about death and the afterlife.